And so now we are the people of God, called out from the world, chosen by the Father, redeemed by the Son, being transformed by the Spirit, and journeying together to that great day when the rule of Christ will fill the earth. And now, together, we do worship our God by submitting to His Word. There He is. A worn-looking man. He's limping forward, dragging his leg behind him. Every step screams with fatigue. He's weary. And now he's bowing face to the ground, limping and bowing and limping and bowing, going forward to meet what will be the greatest threat of his life. How would he possibly limp forward to face his greatest battle? His name is Jacob. And this morning, perhaps many of us could identify with Jacob as we limp into battle with those who would threaten our very existence as people of God. They pose threats to what God is doing in our life and our lifestyle and the way we want to go forward. The very program of God seems to be threatened by these kinds of people around us. And though we may not face people with swords in the pathway of the Middle East, the threat is still very much as real to us. And we are people who limp forward, weary, fatigued, acutely aware that we are frail and fragile for the battle. The battle might be with someone from your own family, a spouse, a son, a daughter, someone who's rebellious in your family, who mocks your Christianity, who makes life so difficult for you in your home, because they've turned your home upside down as they have lived with their self-indulgences. They value nothing that you value, and it would seem that they threaten your very life as a Christian, and you must limp into battle. How do you limp into that kind of a battle? Or perhaps yours is with someone or a group of someones at your office or at your workplace. A group of people who smirk when you pray, who have a whole system of one-upmanship that's based on their self-promotion as they push down everyone else around them. A system that's based in injustice and selfishness. And you won't play that system. And so your life there very much feels to be under threat. What's the best way to limp forward into that kind of a battle? We all face such battles. When the forces of evil, often from the very people who are closest to us, seem to oppose every step we take as God's children. And those are the tough ones. How do you best limp forward in these kinds of battles? This morning we want to answer that question. And what we're going to see is a past story of a man who fought this exact same kind of battle. And the results are so much different. And having looked at that past story, we want to examine a perpetual reality. What continues on from that story across all of time? And then finally, a present response that you and I might make so that we would best limp forward in this kind of battle. Our story has to do with Jacob and Esau. We're back in the book of Genesis where we see once again how indeed God is moving his people forward and his program. So if you'll turn with me to Genesis chapter 33, we'll get a glimpse into how God used this text, I believe, to encourage his people, Israel, who very much felt that they were having to enter the battles of life weak, frail, fragile, without armies, without strength, and yet God was moving them forward. And it's into this setting that God drops this story about how Jacob would encounter his greatest threat, Esau. So what we find here in Genesis chapter 33, first of all, is that Jacob was facing his greatest threat in Esau. Jacob was facing a threat that was severe. In fact, it had gone from, uh-oh, it's going to happen one day, to imminent, it's happening. Genesis chapter 33, verses 1 through 20. See if you can grasp how serious this threat is. We read just the first three verses to start off. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two female servants. He put the female servants and their children in front. And then Leah and her children next. And then Rachel and Joseph in the rear. And then he himself went out on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. Maybe it'd be good for us to remember exactly what has happened in Jacob's life so we get a glimpse of how this terror, this threat is so terrifying for Jacob and for the readers as well. If Jacob had a terrorist advisory system like we have today, it would have gone from, it would be at the highest level. Threat is imminent because Esau's coming. We know the time, we know the place, take cover. He's been sighted, and it looks like the threat cannot be averted. How bad is it? Well, you remember 20 years earlier, Jacob had stolen the blessing from Father Isaac. And when Jacob did that, Esau was so his vow to God, his vow to his parents, his vow to everyone was, I will kill him! And with that ringing in his ears, Jacob fled. He left home. He left his country. He left his family because he knew that Esau, a skilled hunter, certainly was able to take Jacob's life. The threat was real to Jacob, his wives, his children, everyone. The threat of an angry Esau would be such that Jacob could perhaps not even fathom that he'd ever get back in the land. Maybe he'd get away with his life, but to live in the land, to live not far from Jacob, that seemed preposterous. He'd have to flee and always be a bit of a nomad, a person in hiding, a fugitive. The threat was real if Esau's after him. The threat upon Jacob was a threat upon a defenseless man. Here was a man who had just come out of a wrestling match with God. He'd been up all night. He had no energy left. He had been wounded in his hip. He was dragging his leg behind him. He could not defend himself. The threat was real. In fact, the threat is so real that the text says that Jacob divided his family into three different groups. Likely, it would seem, in order to make the most valued ones best able to escape. So he puts out in front, kind of leading the way, his wives who came from a couple of servants along with their children. And then back a ways came Rachel and her children. And then Leah and her children. And then in the third group came Leah and her children. And And Joseph, spoiler alert, that favoritism toward Joseph, it's going to come up in a week or two. The threat is real that he could lose his entire family. So he divides his household. But perhaps for the readers, what they would see most is here is a threat to the future of God's people and his whole program. For you see, if Jacob dies, there is no Israel. If the sons of Jacob, who will become the 12 tribes, if they're eliminated by an angry Esau, there is no movement of the program of God. The threat is real on every level. Esau's coming. And here is Jacob with his face, his head on the ground. Will a man with a sword come and lop off his head? What happens next is absolutely amazing, because this severe, imminent threat is completely averted, and the way it happens, absolutely astounding. Verses 4 through 7 show us, first of all, that the threat of death is averted by reconciliation with his brother. The threat of death is averted by this reconciliation with his brother. Look with me at verse 4. Such a graphic description. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him and threw his arms around his neck and kissed him. And they wept. And then Esau looked up and saw the women and children. "Who are these with you?" he asked. And Jacob answered, "The children that God has graciously given your servant." And then this great processional, the female servants and their children approached and bowed down. And next, verse 7, Leah and her children came and bowed down. And last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. And Esau killed none of them. Here's this man with his lying in the dirt, and Esau running toward him. Can you imagine? I have to wonder if Jacob peeked up to see, is he bringing his sword? But the sword of Esau stayed in its sheath. For 20 years, these men had endured incredible alienation. 20 years without family reunions. 2 full decades of memories from that terrible day when the suspicions of each one toward the other had been ignited and fueled, undoubtedly, with regret and anger, disgust. And now that head that was bowed to the ground was being lifted up by the one who vowed to take it. The neck that had formerly been covered with goat skin to deceive Father Isaac, that neck is now embraced by Esau, who had been the victim. A family kiss 20 years ago had sealed the bitter deception when Jacob had kissed his father and said, "I am Esau." And now the brothers would have a sweet kiss of reconciliation. And tears. Oh, tears. Back in the day, Esau had wept when he learned that Jacob had stolen his father's blessing. Wept in anger, wept in disappointment, wept in despair. And now these two men holding each other up weep with a different kind of tears. 2 Middle Eastern men, covered from dust from the days of travel to get to this rendezvous point, looking at one another as familiar strangers, estranged family, eyes producing tears that cut rivers through the dust on their cheeks. And then the processional. Wives, family. Wives, family. Wives, more children. And Esau never went for his sword. He could have perhaps even claimed them all as his own. He was the firstborn. He was the one who was to be blessed. But he received them all. Threat averted in reconciliation. The story could stop there, but it doesn't. This is a complete aversion of the threat. So this is only one aspect of it, that these brothers who'd been alienated are now able to stand and embrace one another, yet there's not just a reconciliation of brothers, there is a restoration of blessing. The threat is completely averted. Look with me at verses 8 through 11, and notice how the blessing that was stolen is going to be given back. Chapter 33, verse 8. Esau asked, what's the meaning of all these flocks and herds I met? Now, you have to remember that Jacob had sent in front of all the family members. Remember earlier, he had sent his sheep, a bunch of sheep and goats and shepherd, and told them, hey, I want you to take them to Esau so that he'll accept my tribute, that he'll accept this kind of, well, we wouldn't call it a bribe, but this honor that I'm giving him so that perhaps he'll look well upon me, look favorably upon me. So Esau now, having accepted Jacob's wives and children, he says to his brother, what's the thing with the herds and the goats and the flocks? You sent them all. I ran into them yesterday. Here's the answer. Verse 8, to find favor in your eyes, my lord, Jacob said. But Esau said, I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. No, please, said Jacob, if I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me, literally this blessing from me. That's the tribute from me. For to see your face, like seeing the face of God, now that you have received me favorably, please accept the blessing, the present, the NIV says, that was brought to you. For God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need. And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. What's happening here? It's very fascinating to find out that when Jacob sent all of these goats and herds, he sent it in order to win Esau's favor. And Esau wouldn't take it. I'm not taking this tribute that you give to me. But then the language changes just a bit. And Jacob says, no, take this blessing. The idea probably being the very blessing that I stole from you 20 years ago. That blessing I'm now giving back to you because I have found favor in your sight, not in order to gain it. And Esau accepts it. There is restoration of the blessing. That which is wrong has been made right. The stolen property has been returned. The threat of a grudge that would go on and on and on has been eliminated, averted. You see, it'd be one thing for them to have a nice reunion in the middle of the path, but if Esau continued to feel like he had been stolen from, he would harbor a grudge that could not be averted. But now in accepting this blessing, it's a restoration by which we see that the threat from Esau is averted, the threat of a grudge that would continue in the future, gone. I said it's a complete aversion of the threat. There's reconciliation. There's restoration. There's a third thing that happens in this, and that is this threat of a displacement for Jacob is going to be averted here as well, because he's going to end up back in the land. Notice verses 12 through 20 and see where Jacob ends up. Verse 12, then Esau said, all right, let us be on our way. I'll accompany you. But Jacob said to him, my lord knows that the children are tender and that I must care for their ewes and cows that are nursing their young. If they're driven hard just one day, then all the animals will die. So let my lord go on ahead of his servant while I move along slowly at the pace of the flocks and herds before me and the pace of the children until I come to my lord at Seir. That's where Esau's going. His home is in Seir. Verse 15, Esau said, well, then let me leave some of my men with you. If I can't accompany you, then let me send my men along to protect you along the way. Well, Jacob, but why do that? Jacob asked. Just let me find favor in the eyes of my lord. So that day, Esau started on his way back to Seir. Jacob, however, went to Sukkoth, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock, and that is why the place is called Sukkoth, the word for shelters. After Jacob came from Paddan Aram, that's way up in the north where Laban lived, after he came from Paddan Aram, he arrived safely at the city of Shechem in Canaan and camped within sight of the city. For 100 pieces of silver, he bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, the plot of ground where he pitched his tent. And there he set up an altar and called it El Elohe Yisrael. For Jacob, the threat of displacement was averted because he was rested in Canaan. Rested in Canaan. Twice Esau offered protection to Jacob, and twice Jacob said no. In fact, Jacob's a bit deceptive here. He doesn't really come clean with his brother Esau. I'll move slowly and catch up with you at Seir. Well, you must understand that when they parted, Esau went south to Seir, and Jacob went north to Sukkoth. These are not even in the same direction. Now, probably it's good that Jacob didn't go to Seir because it's out of the land of Canaan. Jacob is going to go where God intends for him to go. Shouldn't deceive his brother again. Got him in trouble last time. But indeed, he is going in the right direction. And the text highlights how this is an aversion of a threat, because now at Shechem, he's settled. His wanderings are over. After 20 years of being in exile, he's now settled. His estrangement from the land is going. And at Shechem, verse 18, having come all the way from what is now Syria in the north down to this area across the Jordan River, he's in the land. And the threat of displacement, the threat of homelessness is gone. And so the threat is completely averted. Wow. Reconciliation of the brothers, restoration of the blessing, resting Jacob in the land. Great story, right? But the threat aversion was not just for Jacob as his family. It's for all of Israel. Because those who read this would see that God, that something has happened to preserve the nation itself. How did all this happen? How did this tremendous threat get averted? Here's the most amazing Middle East peace accord in history. And the U.S. didn't even have an intervening role. Was it because of Jacob's ingenuity? Was it because of Esau's generosity? Was it just because a couple of guys decided, hey, we need to reconcile? No, no, no. This all happens because God is fighting for his people and his program. And God himself is the one who reaches in and turns the heart of Esau, threat averted. And God is the one who delivers Jacob to the land, threat averted. How do I know that? Nothing here seems to point out exactly that God is the one who does this, but we read carefully. And when we read carefully, we can see the hand of God so much at work. A couple of indications tell us. Look back at verse 10, and you'll see that God was fighting in Esau. Chapter 33 and verse 10. The critical point, the crux, the hinge for this whole story is where Jacob says, if I have found favor in your eyes, accept this tribute from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God now that you have received me favorably. To see your face is like seeing the face of God. Now, this is the most important FaceTime session you'll ever hear, so listen carefully. You have to remember that back in chapter 32, the preceding chapter, Jacob has said, I'm going to send my herds before the face of Esau. And when my herds go across the face of Esau, he will lift up my face. Our translations kind of smooth that out, but that's really what it says. And then you come to chapter 33, and Jacob finds himself in a wrestling match with God, and God lets him live. And what does Jacob say? I will call this place Peniel, the face, literally, the face of God, because I've seen the face of God, and I have lived. And now he sees Esau. And Esau doesn't kill him. Esau accepts the restoration of the blessing. And what does Jacob conclude? I see in your face, not the face of my tribute, the face of God. The God who fights. The God who fights. That's the one who fights for his people by turning the heart of Esau. Don't miss it. But there's a second indication of God being at work here in this text, and that is this wonderful naming of the altar that Jacob plants when he comes here to Shechem. Did you see it? Verse 20. The name of the altar is going to be El Elohe Israel, the God of Israel, or perhaps saying the God of Israel is God. I find this interesting. He didn't say the God of Jacob. Now, this is not an altar used for sacrifice. This is an altar of testimony. This is an altar that Jacob builds in order to declare, this is my God. And he calls himself by the name that God has given him, Israel, which means what? God fights. You see, the text is saying, look, the God who fights for me is my God. Jacob looked back on his whole incident with Esau, and he understood that arriving in the land and not being engaged with a battle with his brother and the threat from his brother is now going to place him there, and he can attribute the entire victory to the fight from God himself. El Elohe Israel, the God who is God, is my God. And he came, it says, to Shechem, one little line, safely, literally in peace. Extremely important because back in chapter 28, one last comment. Jacob was fleeing from the land. And he prayed to God, oh God, if you will simply bring me back to my father's home, if you'll bring me back to my father's land, then you will, and if you will put me there in peace, bashalom, in shalom, then you will be my God. Chapter 33, 20 years later, what happens? Jacob lands there, and the text says he got there in peace. Verse 18, he arrived at Shechem in peace, in the land of Canaan. And he builds an altar that says, you are my God. the God of Israel. What God was asked to do in chapter 28, God fulfilled in chapter 33. Despite 20 years of wandering and battles, God averted all threats, put Jacob alive with his great family in the land. Wow. The threat was averted by this perpetual, by this reality that God fights by changing the heart of Esau and delivering Jacob to the land. That's the past story. But here's a perpetual reality. God does fight by changing the hearts of those who threaten his work. God continues to fight. He has always fought. He will fight perpetually against those who threaten his people and his programs. It's hard to believe that God works that way. It's slow. It's internal. We don't get to see it. But that's what God does. Andy Howard and I were talking about this text and this reality earlier this week, and Andy told me that he has an older brother. I've not met Andy's brother, and yet he's gave me permission to share with you the story of his older brother who turned from the Lord. They're wonderful Christian family, Christian parents, and yet his brother became extremely rebellious, and he ran out on the family. He became a threat to the Christian lifestyle of the family. He became a threat to all things Christian as he lived a life of drinking and drugs and rejecting his parents. It was a battleground. And what happened in the years after? God reached in and turned the heart of that young man. Because God changes hearts. Threat averted. That young man ended up in Bible school, turning around, living for the Lord. And it's the work of God. God still fights by changing the hearts of people. That's a perpetual reality. But how about a present response? What does that mean for us? Or let's go back to our first question. How do we best limp into battle with those that threaten our lives as God's people? The message of this text is that we limp into battle confident that God fights by changing the heart of his people and getting them to the place where he wants them to be. God fights the battles for us so we can be confident that he will indeed, as he will, change the hearts of those who threaten. He can do that and get us to the place where we need to be. So it may be that for many of us, we feel threatened in that workplace. There are those who would tear us down and perhaps defame your faith. They're set on ruining your testimony and ruining your love for the Lord. They have no appreciation for the church or God's people. And you want to load your guns. You want to fight back. You want to put them down. At least you want to get transferred. Let me get out of here. But our message is, no, you limp into battle. Confident. Not in our strength, but in a God who changes hearts, who fights for his people. That means you got to embrace the limp. You got to accept the weakness. You got to be willing to say, I can't do this, but I have a God who can. For many of us, we sense that the church in America is under threat from social and political and environmental factors that seem bent on marginalizing Christianity, from pro-choice to euthanasia, from sex trafficking to porn production that is now, I understand, affecting over 60% of men in the U.S. Legislation regarding sexuality that promotes homosexuality and transsexuality and gender selection, all these things are perceived by some of us as great threats to our lives as Christians. And it's easy to feel that if we don't fight back, we will lose, and God's people will lose, and God's program will lose. So we need lobbyists, we need rhetoric, we need advertisements, we need politicians, we need laws. And God says, wait, I want you to limp into battle, first of all, confident that our God is in the business of changing hearts. It doesn't mean there's no other action to take. But the forefront of our faith rests not in our skill or our strength. It rests in a God who fights for his people and fights for his program and gets us to the place where he wants us to be. Such an encouraging thing that in a world where Boko Haram and the Fulani herdsmen persecute Christians, in a world where South Sudan is engaged with ethnic and sectarian violence, in a world where North Koreans are ethnically striving with South Koreans, and the Middle East, it's Arabs and Jews, and in Europe where the nationalists see immigrants as nothing but evil, in a world where, in the U.S., where there's black and white and Hispanic tension, that the need for reconciliation screams at us from every corner, we can say we have seen how reconciliation works, not by the strength of people, but by the hand of God, who turns hearts and fights for his people. It can happen. Here's the best way to limp into battle. Confident. Confident that in our weakness, God fights for his people and his program by changing hearts. I find it interesting that in our country now, when there's good information from the Homeland Security or our counter-terrorist agencies, that terrorist attack is quite likely. We have a whole alert system. It warns us and it says, hey, our alert level is now that an attack is imminent. So we will gather our forces, we'll secure our borders, we will do everything we can to make ourselves stronger in order to ward off the attack. Probably good for our government to do. And then they hope the threat will go away. Maybe. But for us, as God's people, there will always be threat of those who will oppose the very people and program of God. And when the threat becomes imminent, our hope can never be in what we can do. It's always in him, the God who fights for his people, for his program. And so, our Father, we confess to you that we are people who would love to see this kind of reconciliation in our world. We'd love to see this kind of reconciliation in our church, in our churches, in our nation. And yet, we also recognize that we are people who are weak and frail. And the only way that reconciliation can certainly happen is if you fight for your people and change the hearts of those who would threaten. So our prayer this morning is that you would change hearts, and may it start with us, that we would not be like Jacob, but that we would see like Jacob the wonderful results of your work. Bless us with that kind of faith, I pray, for Jesus' sake. Amen.